Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk about to people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. My guest today is Northumberland South MP Kim Rudd. Three weeks ago, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau joined Kim at her nomination meeting here in Cobourg. It was a high-profile event that drew attention from many corners of the news media and the community. And while the federal election is slated for next October, it is significant that the start of the campaign in Northumberland County, as it was the first in a series of nominations that will take place over the upcoming weeks and months. Today, I'm going to talk to Kim about that campaign and what to expect in the upcoming days. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you for having me as your inaugural guest on your show. This is pretty exciting, and I remember Consider This has been around for some time in a different format, so great to extend it.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate it. Before we get to the issues, I would like to get some perspective, Kim, about things leading up to the nomination and the campaign. Now, in August, you announced you would not be continuing on as Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Natural Resources. And in both your press release and subsequent news interviews, you said you had to focus your energies on the riding and the issues that matter to your constituents. But in a CBC analysis of polls done in July, you, along with four other parliamentary secretaries, are mentioned as needing a boost at the ballot box. The article says, and I'm quoting, "The Liberals have taken a hit in the polls in Ontario while the New Democrats have surged there. How much of this can be chalked up to the recent provincial campaign is unknown, and polling might return to more familiar patterns after the summer. But applying those shifts to their 2015 election results puts Arif Varney, Selena Cesar Chavins, and Kim Rudd behind their own ridings." Hmm. Kim, are you or others in the Liberal Party concerned about your chances in Northumberland Peterborough South?
Well, first of all, I didn't know about that poll or that article, so there you go. You know, this was a tough election in 2015. Mm-hmm. 2011 was a very tough election. Mm-hmm. I wasn't successful. Mm-hmm. But I truly believe that I had something to give and provide for the constituents. And so I did again in 2015 and was. So I intend to do the exact same thing in 2019. The response I get as I go around the riding is excellent. As I said, I wasn't aware of that poll. It's interesting to me. The Reefer Annie is in there because he's in a Toronto riding, so that's mm-hmm. interesting. And he was an NDP riding, but we never were. So it's just interesting to me when they do polls, how they come up with their analysis. I don't put a lot of stock into them, especially a year out from an election. What I know is that when I gave up the role as parliamentary secretary, one of the big reasons was, as you know, I traveled internationally mm-hmm. a lot. And I had 75,000 miles already this year. And a new minister came in, who I love. Minister Sohi is the new Minister of Natural Resources. And he had lots of work to do domestically. He has the TMX pipeline, of course, as well as the softwood lumber and a number of other things. So his focus was primarily going to be domestic, so which was going to leave me doing more international travel. And that, I just looked back and, you know, as ministers, they get to have more choice about when they travel. So they have a tendency maybe to travel on weeks when we're in Ottawa more. And the parliamentary secretary gets to do more of the travel on the weeks when we're supposed to be in our constituency. And we just looked at my schedule, and between September and December, I was likely going to be back here 1 week. And that wasn't enough for me. It is for a couple of reasons. One, new municipal elections. I have mayors, deputy mayors, and councillors to meet. When was I going to do it? They're not going to come in and meet with me on a Sunday afternoon before I catch a train to Ottawa. We also have a number of big pieces of legislation that are coming down, as you know, and I need to be there to answer questions for my constituents. And we have a new Minister of Seniors. And Minister Tassi and I have been very engaged. I held a town hall for seniors in Brighton during the summer. There have been a number of things going on. And we really see an opportunity in this riding because 40% of our residents are over the age of 55. Mm-hmm. We see an opportunity here to influence that policy on seniors that will have a huge impact in our riding. I can't do that if I'm not here. So that was sort of in the nuts and bolts of why I decided to do it. But as you know, there's no declared candidate for in opposition, whether the Conservatives, I think, have maybe 3-4 candidates, but they're not looking at calling a nomination anytime soon, I don't think. You may know more about that than I. I haven't heard of the NDP or the Green. So for me, it's not really about the election at this point, because there's no one to be having those, you know, debates and other things with. It's more about making sure that I have the temperature, if you will, of my riding to help influence some bigger pieces of legislation and platform items that are going to be there. So I'm making sure I've got the right information to be able to influence.
Okay, then you, at your nomination meeting, though, I mean, usually these things are inside the ballpark. You know, it's a riding. It's usually a very quiet affair. Only if you're a card-carrying member do you even
notice. Oh, we don't have to be cards anymore. You don't have to have a membership in the Liberal Party.
Well, but still, they were often garnered very little attention. And you were uncontested, and yet we had this incredibly high-profile event. The Prime Minister showed up, and I know he's a busy guy with lots going on. But he's not showing up at every nomination meeting. And yet, why did he come here? Why did we have such a big high-profile event if it wasn't to gain traction and get attention?
Well, I think he's done one other, and it's Minister Baines. I think that was the kickoff of nominations, and he did that for Minister Baines. And yes, I am number two, and my colleagues remind me of that in Ottawa in a very teasing way. You know, you got the Prime Minister. There were a number of reasons, and it was symbolic. Do you remember, well, I'm sure you remember, in October of 2015 when the Prime Minister, with very little notice, decided he came to Port Hope and we ended up hoping to have 250 people. It was Thanksgiving Monday and people were with families. Yeah. And we had 1,000 people and closed off the streets and it was a phenomenon, if you will.
Yes.
When we were talking about the third anniversary of our election, the Prime Minister, in a conversation with me, sort of on the sidelines in the lobby, said, you know, he said, we should do something to recognize. And one of the biggest moments we had was Port Hope. And I said, well, what would you like us to do? He says, well, I don't know, but we'll think about it. And from that thinking about it, I got a call from the PM. And they said, how do you think about the PM coming to celebrate the third anniversary with you? And I said, okay. And great. And what it turned out to be was I was in Whitehorse, Victoria, Edmonton, and Winnipeg that week on the finance committee. I got back late Thursday night, and the Prime Minister came Friday. So, you know, my team and everyone did a great job. But that's how it came about. It was really about the celebration and where we felt. Many people said they felt that we turned that day in Port Hope.
I've heard that.
And this was a recognition of coming back. And this, as I said at the event, the Prime Minister has been an MP, this is his fifth visit to our riding. He'd been here before he was an MP in the speaker series with the United Way. Many of us remember that.
Yes.
So this riding is important to him. And I was asked by CBC that night, what do you think what would you say about him being here? Or what does it say about the Prime Minister being here? And I said two things. One, he has great faith in me, and this riding is important to him.
While he was here, it was not all fun. He did do some talking to some dairy farmers in the area. And I just, with that meeting beforehand, with the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the USMCA, going to be a major issue then in Northumberland, and what did he say in the meeting?
Well, I should tell you how that meeting came about. So I've been talking to a number of dairy farmers since the agreement came to pass. And Sid Atchison, who sits on the provincial board, and Will van der Horst, both I know well. And Sid picked up the phone and called me and said, Kim, what do you think the chances are of the Prime Minister? 48 hours before the Prime Minister was coming, what do you think the chances are? I said, I don't know, because the schedule got all changed around because of Don McDonald's funeral. So the timing got sort of moved around. So I called and he said, let's figure out a way to make it work. So the Prime Minister said, let's figure out a way to make it work. So we did. We got to sit down with them. It was a great meeting in that that, and I'm going to Sid's house on Thursday next week, and we're going to, he's bringing the dairy farmers in, and we're going to sit around his kitchen table and have a good conversation. What the meeting did for us as mm-hmm. government was provide context to some of these things that were being talked about. So an example is, you know, the Prime Minister understands that there's issues at the border with milk coming about the regulations about what's getting in over the border not necessarily being enforced. Sometimes that's because they don't necessarily know, you know, if it's white and it moves, it's probably milk, but it could be cream. And that makes a big difference in terms of value. So they were able to explain sort of the minutiae of some of tightening that border, if you will, to what it could mean to them and the significance. So the Prime Minister learned. He was able to tell them that we intend to continue to defend supply management. If you remember 9 or so months ago, President Trump said there'd be no agreement without the complete dismantling of supply management. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't dismantle. We gave up a little. And they understand, but what they're looking for is how we can help them continue to grow and have success. They're not looking for compensation. They're looking for clarity and comfort that we will be supporting them as a government to continue to grow the dairy market in whatever ways we can and ensure that they have viable operations. And the Prime Minister absolutely committed to that.
But when the first took place, there was a lot of talk by dairy farmers that small farms were going to be in jeopardy, that this mm-hmm. was going to be a bigger blow than anybody truly realized. Is that feeling still being held? I mean, the way you're talking to me right now, it doesn't sound like that. But yet, I bet you if you walked up and started knocking on doors out in the townships, there'd be lots of guys out there saying, you know, I'm in jeopardy. This is my future is at stake here with this. What are you saying to those guys?
Well, this week, I met with Canadian dairy farmers. So the National Association came into my office and the four of them, and we chatted. And they, from a national and provincial perspective, and even the local, part of the challenge is there's no text. The only text that they've had that got them sort of very worried mm-hmm. was the U.S. text that was released. And it's not right. So the final text of what was negotiated is not released yet, and the details aren't worked out. So they understand that the information that they received from the U.S., which was a leaked document, is not the right information. So they know that now. So that's taken away some of the angst. Minister Freeland and Minister McCauley have been able to share with the association some of what the real information is, and that's given some comfort. The other thing that's given comfort is let's remember, the thing that most stresses people is when they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so when you continue to have conversations and you can update them and listen and answer the questions to the extent you can, that creates comfort. So now we have two tables that were just announced, both a short-term table and a longer-term table that will be made up of government, dairy farmers, industry folks. And the two tables will be basically run by the dairy farmers themselves.
So just for those who are not familiar with the political terms, what's a table?
A table is a meeting group that is comprised of folks who have a vested interest and also have the ability to influence and make change. So there's a number of things they brought to us that they think could really help mitigate mm-hmm. some of what this this quota, the restriction, and one of them is the border.
Today, Foreign Minister Christine Freeland said in an interview that dairy was something that they had to give up as part of the negotiations. And we know how political campaigns go, and these things kind of gather momentum and become slogans that are often used against the government. Are you concerned that this kind of rhetoric might get out there when she's admitting that, you know, this was something that they had to give up, and dairy farmers are going to feel like, you know, we were the ones that were the sacrificial lambs, if you will.
Or cows.
To get this deal.
I've heard it a little bit, but I've heard it in the context of frustration about not knowing and not being involved. And And the associations and the organizations were in discussions with Minister Freeland as this was being negotiated. And they tell me that they all knew they'd have to give up. They figured that they'd have to give up something. It was more, I think, than they anticipated, which I get. But they also recognize that this is a national agreement and that there are many sectors and many pieces in it that we were able to, I don't want to say give and a take, because, dairy farmers feel that they've given a lot, and they have. But there were some things that we need to make sure we maintained as well, and the auto sector be one of them, as well as the trade that goes between Canada and the U.S. and how important it is to jobs, frankly, on both sides of the border.
But if I'm a farmer sitting out in Alnwick Haldimand Township in my kitchen and I'm looking at my books, I may not feel too much pride for the country and maybe not magnanimous enough to want to say, okay, it was for the good. I don't mind taking
the greater
it for the
good,
team.
As it were, yeah.
Yeah. So how then do you talk to those people when you're out on the campaign to get them to understand your position?
It is one-on-one conversations, and that's why I talk to so many of the dairy farmers who want to talk to me. Got a call scheduled with me, and I did that. And Sid, my able to get our folks in front of the Prime Minister, the Canadian dairy farmer said to me, like, that's huge to be able to get that. They had at least 15 minutes with him, and that's a lot. But the other thing is, when Sid brings his dairy farmers around the table to have the conversation with me next week in his kitchen table, that'll be the time for them to have the opportunity to tell me what this means to them, what their suggestions are. And I have a direct line into Minister McCauley, Minister Freeland, and the Prime Minister on this issue. Like, that's been made very clear by the Prime Minister. So everything we're getting, we're feeding straight up. Then those tables, as I mentioned earlier, will be the place where they figure out what the solution is. Understanding that the goal is to ensure we have a robust dairy sector in this country, and we will do what we need to do to make sure that happens.
You spend a lot of time talking about it, but again, we have to remember that agriculture is one of the largest industries in Northumberland.
It absolutely is.
I'm glad we talked about that. Now, moving on then, when you sit down with your campaign team, what are the local issues that you're identifying that are key to the campaign that's coming up?
Engagement certainly is one of them. And by engagement, I'll be in all the Santa Claus parades that can manage to get, and I think I have three or four in one day because of scheduling, and sometimes they're at the same time, so I try and alternate. There's that kind of public sort of event engagement, and of course that's important. People want you to be in their communities, and we have a lot of communities. But the other engagement, and I think maybe the more purposeful engagement, is where I will actually, today I was at Palisade Gardens and chatting with some seniors about and helping them sort of navigate some of what they hear. Because, you and I have had this conversation about the lack of print media, the lack of local, and how we have organizations stepping up to the plate, like Today's Northumberland and others. And for seniors, that's not really sort of the world they live in. So helping them, know they can call at any time if they have a question or they're frustrated with something, don't hesitate. So it's those one-on-one conversations. So I'm doing a tour of a number of the seniors' residences around the riding. I'm also doing a number of, I'm going to see FP Pharma next week. It's a big manufacturer for our riding. We have a new spa out at Northumberland Heights that's just opening up, and I want to talk to them about their business opportunities and where they see they are. The more I know about the lives and the businesses, this summer I spent, because the provincial election was on even after it was over, lots of people were tired of politicians and the municipal election was going to start. So instead of going talking to people at their doors, I did Main Streeting in Brighton and Colborne and went in and talked to businesses. I remember Lens RV in Brighton went in. They said, no, nobody's ever come in to ask us how our RV business is doing. And I said, well, I want to know. We had a great conversation. So it's finding ways to get to the heart, if you will, of what lives are in this riding. That's key.
So that's a big contrast to, you know, when we look at the media and we look at what's being debated. I mean, you know, topics like immigration, climate change, you know, indigenous issues, the debt, the deficit, carbon pricing, veterans, all those things are floating around. And yet you haven't mentioned any of those. Are those not important to you?
It's interesting. There is that we certainly do get emails or phone calls or people coming in on those issues. But when you think we have 110,000 residents and you might get 30, you put it into context. So it might be something people hear and they want to know more about it, mm-hmm. but they're not at a place where they're necessarily really for, really against. And the only way you actually get, you engage them on that issue is by talking to them. And so there will always be what I will call hot button issues and issues that are out there with less than fulsome, correct fulsome information that will stir people's, you know, get the ire up of people. But you deal with them with facts, and the majority of people are interested in hearing the facts and the data and providing them the information. Other people are not. Other people, you know, social media, I was on CTV Power Play. I'm a regular there now on Wednesdays. And we had to talk about Tony Clement this week mm-hmm. and that situation. And we're all being extremely respectful. And as I reminded viewers on that show, he has a wife and three children. And we need to allow them to deal with this and not, yes, it's there. And the RCMP is looking at security issues. And that's all important. But we need to leave it where it needs to be left. And the conversation came around to female MPs particularly and what we're subjected to on social media and by telephone and by email. And, you know, there's a button called hide on social media. If someone has a dissenting comment to make, that's great. I love when there are disparate views. But when people call you names you'd never repeat, when they suggest that you shouldn't be on the earth anymore, things like that, that goes too far. And we see more and more of that all the time. And it's, I think some of it's an influence from the U.S., but it's something, the only way you can counter it is by face-to-face.
I want to talk more about that, but first we're going to take a commercial break. And I'm here with Kim Rudd, our MP for Northumberland Peterborough South. Stay tuned to consider this on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. It's good to have you back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn. My guest today is Northumberland Peterborough South MP Kim Rudd. We are talking about the federal election campaign, which might seem really far away, and yet in politics, it's actually not. The clock is ticking down. We were talking before the break, Kim, about social media and its impact. Could you maybe give us some idea what you face in terms of social media? You talked about some of the tools that are used, but have you actually experienced this kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you share a story with us about what that's like?
Well, there's been a couple that sort of stand out to me. I remember when I was parliamentary secretary to Jim Carr, Minister of Natural Resources, and we were sitting in the House just before member statements, and it was on a Wednesday, and we had just had a conversation at caucus earlier that day, and of course caucus is secret, but it was around sort of what we are facing and how we're dealing with it and suggestions and should, you know, what should we do about this. And as a male, Jim said, you know, is this a thing for you? And I said, yes. I said, it doesn't happen as often to me, I think, as it does to some of my colleagues. But yes, it is. So we were sitting down, we sit right beside each other, and I happened to get an alert on my phone, and I opened it up, and it was a message. It was a private message, and how people get to do that, I don't understand at all, on Twitter. And I won't repeat the language because I just would not. It was that bad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, discussing female anatomy and calling you names and saying the, you know, I wish you were dead. And so I said to Jim, I said, here's what you call timing. So he was shocked. And he'd never experienced anything like that. So that's one. And another was, and I guess the other thing is the anonymity that people feel behind a keyboard. Except sometimes it's not anonymous because they have a profile and they have a picture and they don't think about that. And so there was one instance where someone I've known for 35 years, you know, casually, but, you know, involved with sports and back in the day. And there was a meme going around, or a meme, on social media, on Facebook, that was very racist. And this person shared it. And it was completely off the wall, inappropriate. I thought maybe he'd been hacked, because that does happen. Mm-hmm. And so I sent a private message and saying, just so you know, this is on your Facebook. And he said, yes, I put it there. And I said, and it was racist towards Muslims. And the information was completely inaccurate. It was absolutely inaccurate. You know how those things go. And so I wrote him a note because I felt I knew his wife, I knew his kids. And so I wrote him a note and I said, I want you to understand from a personal perspective how this affects me. And I said, my son-in-law is Muslim and they're having a baby and that baby will be Muslim. And I said, what you're saying is you're saying those things about my grandchild, about someone who came to this country at 17 years old as a refugee all by himself. Put himself through Seja, put himself through university. He's an accountant. He works for a firm here. He's just an amazing man. And you don't know anything about him or any other Muslims, as we've had so many refugees come to this country. The churches, Rotary, others supporting the families are here because they're fleeing something. And we can't even imagine what that's like. And I said, you know, I would really appreciate it if you would not do this, because I don't know that you realize the impact this has. And he said, well, it's fine. He may be one of the good ones. And if he conforms to us, then that's fine. And that was the end of the conversation.
Do you get concerned coming into an election campaign about the role of social media locally? We watched it a lot in the provincial election and then even in the municipal election. Facebook groups, Twitter feeds, postings that go up. How does that impact when you're sitting down and thinking about campaigns and strategies?
Well, it's, you know, I believe politicians at their peril ignore the other voices, the anti-voices, so people who don't support what you're doing. And it's easy to say, oh, it's just them, and they don't know what they're talking about. They often know what they're talking about in terms of what their reality is. And you can't ignore that. So when I use this example, the person I'm referring to has never been to one of the events where we have the multicultural events. And growing up in Coburg, our exposure, I think Stats Can just, they came out with the 2016 census, and 90% of our population in this riding is white Anglo-Saxon. And of the 10% that is their immigrants, the majority of them are from the UK. It's just the way it is. So when your exposure to other cultures and things and other experiences isn't really broad, you're responding from your own experience, which is valid. Where I think our role as politicians lies is that we have to help inform those people who don't have a fulsome view of the situation or the conversation.
But let's take an example. I mean, you look at the race in Port Hope, and there was a back and forth about a building and people, and it came down to a for and against, and it was vitriolic on social and extremely divisive. So my question to you then is that as somebody going in, I mean, you can say all you want. I don't think there would have been anything that would have moved at either side. And yet that became a focal point for a campaign and you know, almost a referendum for the town. How do you respond to that? How does your campaign team respond to that going into a federal election campaign?
We have to be prepared for it. And the only way you can really be prepared for it, well, there's probably a couple of ways. One, you know, you have to be ready. You have to have your facts ready. You have to have your information in a way that people can understand. That's number one. Number two is you have to be open to hearing other opinions. And if indeed the opinions are something you can work with, or then you have to be open to moving. Having said that, there are things where you won't move. And I'll give you the example. You talked about the Port Hope municipal election. A good friend of ours who was running, he and his husband adopted has had a surrogate. His name is Gus, and he's about 8 months old, and he's the cutest thing you'd ever want to see. And Miles is a professor at UOIT and manages it's around their diversity department. And Miles got some pretty severe hate mail because he was gay and that he should not be running and that he indeed was looking to have, you know, a gay boy. It was, I won't go into the detail because it was pretty offensive. But though that's something that I don't care what someone that has the opinion that that's okay, I would never move on that. So you have to find your line and your principle, and you have to stick to it. But on things where there is room to be convinced, you know, about whether you go to the building as an example, maybe there was room. I don't know. I was not really involved in it. But you have to be open to that. And I know it was a very divisive issue in Port Hope.
Does social media affect the outcome of elections?
I think it can if it's not used in a responsible way. And Ontario Proud, to me, is one of the examples. So Ontario Proud was very involved in the provincial election, and they've now turned their sights to the federal election. And one of the things, we have a bill before, I think it's C-76, bill before the House on financing for elections, federal elections. As you know, or you may know, every Canadian person can donate up to $1,500 to a candidate. That's it. No more. If you own a business, your business can't donate. It has to be you. In the U.S., you could donate $20 million to your candidate. We don't have that. And in the U.S., you hear of something called PACs or super PACs. And people didn't think we had them here, but we do. And what they are nonprofit organizations created that you can donate as much as you want to because you'll get a tax receipt. And then they can do the advertising, hence Ontario Proud. And so I think, and we've got a piece of legislation in to limit that funding, and I think it's really important. I think there is a responsibility of people on social media to be factual, to be passionate, and to be respectful. And there has to be a counter to those who aren't, but you have to be very careful because sometimes the countering with fact just opens up a whole new conversation.
That sounds really utopian because when you get out there and when it really goes, I mean, I've never seen it ever behave that way.
I know, but I'm saying that's how it has. If it were if it were to have an influence on elections in a positive way by helping inform voters about all sides of an argument, every political party, it could do it could have a huge impact on getting more people out to vote, more people engaged in the political spectrum. That would be an amazing thing. Unfortunately, it's being used to target and divide. And because of that, I think it is having an impact on elections, but I don't think it's a good impact. I think it's making people say, I don't want to be involved in this.
Do you have a strategy locally or people locally that look after that?
I do, yes. And it's almost a full-time volunteer job for folks who monitor that kind of thing. And going into the campaign, the other thing you have to do as an MP is you have to keep your campaign and your MP duties very separate. So they're handled very separately. But there are people, that's all they do in the campaign is deal with media.
Earlier in the conversation, we talked, you've mentioned, about talking to people and hearing from some others through social media and through talking to them directly. You must get a lot of political advice. Not just from your team, but I would imagine from your party, and I bet even from people on the street when you're just walking down the road. Can you describe your process for gleaning all this and deciding what it is that you actually do?
Oh, that's a really good question. Actually, you'd be surprised how little political direction we get from the party or from it's just not the whole idea of what we're doing is really about us being in our communities. And so there is an expectation that the work that you're doing in your riding is representing your riding. So the direction isn't coming, and I know that sounds a bit weird, but it's just not. For me, if you ask me who I get the most advice from, it's people on the street. It's my friends. It's at social engagements. It's at if people want to tell me what they think. So they want me to do something. They like this, but they don't like that. And they think we should have pushed back on this. My husband is one of the people who gives me the most advice, not always the best, because he's my husband, 40 years. I mean, his reaction is, well, that's not what you said, or that's not who you are. Like, you have to push back. And I'm more circumspect in making those decisions. And so for me, it's the best conversations I have where people say, yeah, I didn't really like how, you came down on this side of you guys, the party, or the government or whomever. I really didn't like sort of how you framed that. I think you should have done it this way. That's really good information for me.
But then how do you decide in the midst of all of that? Because, of course, you know, you have the government, they'll do what they're going to do, and you have the people reacting to do that. Where do you find the time to sort of sit and go, well, this is what Kim Rudd thinks, or this is what Kim Rudd's going to do?
Well, interesting. So a couple of things. I take the train back and forth every week to Ottawa. So there's some good time there to both work and reflect. And the reflection is very important. You do need to step back and say, okay, what was that? I mean, I will do a lot after this week in the riding, because I will be out everywhere and I will hear a lot. And I will take time to reflect, and I will download it, and I will bounce it off people, both on my team, my husband, my daughter, who is another one of my, will tell me the truth. And you need people like that in your life. They're close to you. Don't tell me that was great when I know it's not. Tell me the truth. That helps me. But I also, we have caucuses in government, and we have a rural caucus. It's the second largest caucus in government. We also have an Ontario caucus. And that's where we come, and we, in the cone of silence, if you will, hash out those things that are important to us, our riding, us personally, where our lines are, and come and find a path forward that we can all agree on. We don't always agree. I mean, we're not... Unanimity in a group of 180 people is not possible. But the common thread is the same, which is getting to the right outcome for our constituents and for Canadians. So
can you share a story where you had all this advice and you went your own path?
Oh, gosh, yeah. There have been a couple of those. Probably around, I'm trying to think. Yeah, probably around the work that we did in access to broadband and broadband and cell service. So the rural caucus is extremely, it's very tight. Rural includes Labrador and Nunavut. It also includes all the Nakatomiak Township. So the issues aren't all the same, but again, there's a thread. And we brought Minister Morneau in around the small business tax issue that happened last summer. And I had a personal conversation with Bill about it, because I'm a small business owner. Mm-hmm. I knew where we were trying to get, but our communication wasn't good, and we didn't articulate where we were trying to go, so it was very confusing for people, and people got upset. So I had a personal conversation with the Minister of Finance and said, I can't support this, because this isn't what we need to do. This is not where we need to go. This is how we get there. I had my own opinion, and I was very strong and very vocal about it. I brought that to Rural Caucus. They also had strong opinions. And Ontario caucus, it got to national caucus. And Mr. Morneau came to us and said, okay, I get it. Give me your best advice. So we did. And when Minister Morneau came to the riding next door to us, to make the announcement about the changes and how it wouldn't affect farmers and the ability to hand it down to your family was not going to be affected in terms of capital gains and all of that, he invited me to the announcement. So that's where I said, no, it's not right. But there's a difference between you can't just say no without having a possible solution or at least a conversation, something that starts the conversation about a solution. So, yeah, I stood firm and I influenced policy.
When you go knocking on doors, I'm sure it's nice when you knock on a door and it's somebody who supports you, but I'm sure there's other times when you knock on a door and they're not supporters. You've talked a lot about listening to people. When somebody says something that you don't necessarily agree with, that it's ideologically different, does it have an impact on your campaign, how you shape the issues, how you talk about things? I mean, does the negative sometimes have the same impact?
Good discourse about with disparate views is always helpful because it helps me understand where they're coming from. And that's why I talked earlier about finding ways, if you can move on something, on what you understand it to be, coming from my experience, to someone telling me what their experience is and getting me to come closer to them, that's a good conversation. When people just want to yell at you, I had somebody spit in my face in the last campaign when I knocked on their door, like that's too much. The way, if people, it's going back to only listening, if you only listen to people who agree with you, you'll never move forward. So I think those conversations are very important. And people will come up to me in events saying, you know, I didn't vote for you and I really don't like Anna, but I like what you've done on this. And I want to know more about why. And what, so tell me what you don't like we're doing and help me understand. And people are shocked that I actually want to hear an opinion that's not one that I have. There are some things I won't move on. And, you know, there are people who, there was a, you may know about the recent article about the couple from Bowmanville that were kicked out of the Calgary Baptist Church in Oshawa because they're gay. People who have been involved in that church for years in the youth group, in volunteering. If someone said to me that they thought that was okay, we're not going to have a conversation about that because that is a line. There's no way you'd move me on that.
We've just watched an American election where politics has been incredibly deeply divisive. Do you get concerned that kind of divisiveness it might filter up into ridings like Northumberland, Peterborough South?
I think it is.
Already?
I think it is. And last year, about this time, I had a conversation with Josh Wingrove, who you may know from Bloomberg in Ottawa. And I was coming out of the house, and he said, Kim, and I know Josh. He's tons of respect for him. And he said, you know, they've given me a job of writing a piece, not just a newspaper article, as he often does, but a piece on populism and whether we're at risk in Canada. And that was a year ago. And I said, I just don't think Canadians. We're different. We're... And so we had about probably a 15-minute conversation, and I reflect on that conversation often, because if he'd asked me that tomorrow, I would not give the same answer. I watched the Monk debate the other night between Steve Bannon and David Frum, and two things came to that. I had a conversation with Susan Delacourt, who is also a friend, and we were talking privately that night and sort of on, you know, back channel of social media. And I said, I have a newfound respect for David Frum. I thought he did a good job. I said, on one hand. I said, on the other hand, here we have a discussion between two Republicans, one on the very right side of the Republican Party, and the other what I would call more moderate Republican. But we're talking about times of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and in that conversation, that seemed very moderate.
Is it going to affect the way you're going to run your campaign?
I don't know, actually. Good question. I think part of what will determine that is what the reaction is from constituents. We get it. We get people coming in to our office, and we've had to call the police. Mm-hmm. We get people calling and berating and just awful to the staff. And I don't, those kinds of actions are something that I take a hard line on. So if out in the campaign trail we run across more of that, then we will have to make some decisions about, even in the, was it the 2011 election? I was actually coming out of, it was a high school in Trenton, and I was coming up the aisle, and my staff got sort of, my volunteers got sort of away from me, mm-hmm. or I got away from them, depending on how you look at it. I'm coming up, and two of Rick's folks blocked me from coming up and were yelling at me. And they've apologized since, and we're all good. And you know, I went to Rick, and I said, Rick, I don't make a big deal of this, but that was not a good place. And he was very upset. And, you know, Rick is a gentleman, and that was not. And people were emotional, and they get emotional in campaigns. So we'll see how it goes. I will always be respectful to people, even if they don't agree with me, but I expect the same in return.
Kim, thank you for this conversation. It's been amazing. I know you're an extremely busy person, and I'm grateful for you to take out the time to come and talk to me today and share with our listeners. Next week, Coburg Mayor-elect John Henderson will be joining me to talk about his vision for Coburg as he takes office. I want to thank you for listening to this first show, and if you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com. That's capital C, consider, capital T, this, capital N, Northumberland. Thanks, Google, for making me have to do that. You can go to my Facebook page, Consider This, and on Twitter, I'm at R Wash. I will read out a selection of your comments on my show next week. If you'd like to listen to this or any other podcasts, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. You'll find past podcasts, news and information about life and politics in Northumberland County. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this, Northumberland.